Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Buzzkillers, it's the old professor here, and the buzzkill has landed. Yes, indeed, we are in London. And in fact, we are here in the center of London, in the Houses of Parliament, actually in the Houses of Parliament, interviewing Dr. Caroline Shenton, one of my favorite historians, author of a very important book, The Day Parliament Burned Down, published by Oxford University Press in 2013. Dr. Shenton, tell us, what do you do here in the Houses of Parliament?
Hi, Joe. Well, up until last year, I was director of the Parliamentary Archives.
I'm Professor Buzzkill.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
We have stalking problems.
Let's try again.
We have to, we have to security and everything.
Sorry. Hi, Professor Buzzkill. Thank you for inviting me here. Up until last year, I was director of the Parliamentary Archives here at Westminster. But since last September, I've been working on a programme to potentially find us a new home. The archives are stored inside the palace itself, the Palace of Westminster. And some of your listeners might have heard that the Houses of Parliament are in a bit of a state and need restoring. And so that means that there's an opportunity for us potentially to look for a new home. So that's what I'm working on at the moment.
Now, are the archives still in the Victoria Tower? That's the larger of the two towers.
That's the big square tower at the other end of the palace from the clock tower, and that was built as Parliament's purpose-built archive repository.
Right,
and it designed as that by Charles Barry.
Right, okay, and I think buzzkillers of my vintage will remember their first image of the Houses of Parliament hard up against the River Thames, and the embankment there. Is the BBC test card at the end of Monty Python shows. And they'll remember that the tower on the left, the biggest square one, is the Victoria Tower, where the archives were stored. Well, where are we now, though?
So now we're recording inside Westminster Hall itself, which is the oldest part of the Houses of Parliament, the great beating constitutional heart, if you like, of the building, with its wonderful Anglo-Norman stone walls. So these are walls that date back to the end of the 11th century. They were constructed in 1098, 1099. This massive space that was originally the feasting hall of William Rufus, the son of William the Conqueror. For many centuries, this was the largest secular space in the world. And at the end of the 14th century, another king, Richard II, decided to replace the roof. So what we have above us, looking up, are these massive oak beams with wonderful carved angels on them, all holding shields with heraldic symbols on. And it's called a hammer beam roof. It's a special kind of medieval construction, which entirely supports itself based on the balance of weight across the beams. It's a really spectacular masterpiece of medieval carpentry and one of the great buildings of Europe.
And it's, I think, one of the largest hammer beam roofs still extant.
I think it is the largest hammer beam roof,
Doesn't surprise me at all. What sort of things have happened? What sort of things have happened in the hall, historic events, but also how is the hall used today? We see tourists here. There's an art exhibition here around us. What is its sort of government function, constitutional function, political function?
Well, in the past, it was used for a variety of purposes. It was used for state trials. So this is where the trials of William Wallace, Braveheart, took place. The trial of Thomas More, for those of your listeners who like Wolf Hall and so on. This is where it took place. And this is also where the state trial of Charles I took place. So huge events took place actually in the hall. Whenever there was a coronation of a monarch, the subsequent massive banquet that took place happened here in Westminster Hall, just across the road from the Abbey. And that was a great piece of state ceremonial that last occurred in 1820.
Right.
It was also over the centuries the home of the law courts. And so up until the 1820s, this is where the Court of the Chancery and the King's Bench and so on met. And the reason why there's the banners that you mentioned hanging around the building at the moment is that we're celebrating 800 years of Magna Carta this year. And these are banners which are portraying the various effects that Magna Carta had on British liberty and freedoms and so on. Magna Carta is related to Westminster Hall in a very particular way. Magna Carta isn't a parliamentary document. It predates Parliament. But Magna Carta itself, if you like, gave birth to Parliament, because one of the terms of Magna Carta was that taxes shouldn't be imposed without the consent of the people, and that ultimately led to the creation of the Westminster parliamentary system as we understand it now, with the Lords and the Commons and the monarch combining to provide consent to taxes by the government.
Especially taxes, right? They're called to meet more often about taxes in the beginning than anything else.
And also Magna Carta said that the law courts should be held in a fixed place from 1215 onwards, and that place was selected as Westminster Hall, which is why the law courts sat in there for many centuries.
Now, have monarchs and famous politicians and generals and people like that laid in state in Westminster Hall?
Yes, so in modern times, in the last sort of 150 years or so, whenever a monarch dies or a great leader dies in the UK, they lie in state. That is, that they rest in their coffin for a few days in the hall, and people across the country come to pay their respects and process past. The last time that happened was in 2002, when Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, that's the mother of the current Queen, died, and she laid in state. But the most famous lying in state was that of Winston Churchill.
Right.
In 1965, which is 50 years ago.
Right. Oh, that's right. There's another
anniversary. 2015 is a massive year of parliamentary anniversaries.
Well, we'll get back to Winston Churchill a little bit later in the show. Now, it's a great building. It's a beautiful building. It's an iconic building. Almost everyone knows what it looks like. And it's an old building, or relatively old building. There must be tons of historical myths related to what goes on here, how it was built, procedures, traditions, and on and on and on. Can you run us through a few of those?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there are loads of them that might be more familiar to UK listeners, but for US listeners, perhaps the best myth to bust at this point is about Big Ben. What is Big Ben? People talk about Big Ben as being the tower that looms over the building with the big spiky point on the top and the clock face and so on. Well, that isn't actually Big Ben. Big Ben is the name of the great hour bell inside the tower. The tower is called the Clock Tower of the Palace of Westminster.
Right.
Renamed, actually, 2 years ago for the Queen's Jubilee. Actually, sorry, 3 years ago for the Queen's Diamond Jubilee. Renamed the Elizabeth Tower. Personally, I can never quite get used to that name.
Does anybody say that?
Well, they do say that. That is the official new name, but it's a bit difficult to get out of old habits. So it is the Clock Tower, the tower, and Big Ben is the bell.
So how often does Big Bell sound? What is it used for?
Big Ben, the big bongs come on the hour.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're up actually in the belfry at the time that happens, that is a sort of not quite an ear-bleeding experience, but pretty close to it. So it sounds every hour. But then on the quarter hour, there are quarter chimes as well, which are the ones that play part of the famous tune.
Mm-hmm.
And then it all comes together on the hour.
Right. I think Big Ben is probably the most iconic part of the structure. It's the thing that most of our buzzkillers will know. And I think most people do think that it's the clock tower, because, of course, the clock itself is very famous.
On time. Can people hear that? Probably not.
Well, we'll amp it up. Buzzy will amp it up. But there it is.
That's a quarter to.
Quarter to ten.
So that's the three of the quarter chimes going off there.
Right. What else now? That what else about the building do we misunderstand as myths?
Well, another myth. This is about the building and Parliament in general. There's a well-known or supposedly well-known quote that Westminster is the mother of parliaments. Mm-hmm. And you hear this all the time from politicians and journalists and other people. And that's actually a misquote. It's the misquote from the words of John Bright, who was a radical MP in the 19th century, in the 1860s. And in 1865, what he actually said was that England is the mother of parliaments. Mm-hmm. What he meant by that was that, you know, over the centuries, England has developed this parliamentary system.
Right.
And for a long time, Parliament was, if you like, an event mm-hmm. where the most powerful people in the land gathered to make decisions and so on. It wasn't an institution. It wasn't an organisation.
Right.
So I think that phrase, England, the mother of parliaments, is gives a much more sense of the sort of historical continuity of Parliament over the centuries. But people misquote it as Westminster is the mother of parliaments, perhaps meaning, you know, Westminster is the mother of, you know, like the mother of all wars.
Right.
You know, well, that it's somehow the biggest one, the most important one,
right.
Because they're thinking of those countries across the world that have adopted the Westminster form of legislature.
Right.
Not like the US, but places like Australia, Canada,
right.
New Zealand, and so on.
What's where called you have the Westminster model.
The Westminster model, exactly. Yeah.
So it's an understandable mistake, but I think it is important to think that what the original phrase is saying is it is England and English political traditions that give birth to parliamentary
exactly
government.
Exactly so.
And not
yep.
parliamentary government that gives
yes,
birth to parliamentary
exactly.
government.
That's right.
Yeah, right. Well, that's a good one. What about the things that happen or don't happen or haven't happened within the House of Commons, the House of Lords, other parts of the building?
Things that haven't happened. Well, another myth that we often hear, I guess some of your listeners might have seen Prime Minister's Question Time. Is that televised on C-SPAN?
C-SPAN shows it,
That sort of
and
causes...
And BBC America.
Okay, so but I don't know if that's the sort of a spectacle as far as your listeners go.
Yeah, but. Well, we have listeners in 34 countries, believe it or not. Although most of them are in the United States, so.
Okay. So for anybody who's seen the televisation of Prime Minister's Question Time, which happens every Wednesday when Parliament is sitting, you will see the two benches, the two rows of benches opposite each other in the House of Commons. That is in fact based on the floor plan of St. Stephen's Chapel, which was in the Middle Ages the royal chapel of the palace mm-hmm. that ultimately became the House of Commons chamber. Then the House of Commons burned down in 1834, but the floor format was kept in the new palace and is still there today.
Can I just stop you there to make sure that our listeners understand that in England, the standard arrangement of pews in English chapels is not facing the altar, but is parallel along, well, perpendicular.
Parallel to the walls.
Parallel
yeah.
to the walls and perpendicular to the altar. And so when you have two groups of people, they are facing each other across
yeah.
the altar,
yeah.
so to speak.
Yeah.
That's why it looks that way on C-SPAN.
And it's often said that the distance between the two front benches are a sword's width apart or two sword's widths apart to prevent the members from dueling each other. And this is just utter nonsense. The reason that they are that space apart is that originally that would have been the gap down the middle of these two rows of parallel benches that would have allowed the priest in the mm-hmm. medieval chapel and perhaps two acolytes to walk down the centre of the chapel towards the altar during service. It's got absolutely nothing to do with swords, and particularly not in the Victorian building. You know, nobody mm-hmm. was dueling in the you know in the middle of the 19th century, and nobody would have been allowed to take a sword into the chamber, even if they'd got one. So
right.
that's total nonsense.
Well, that chamber that everyone sees is, of course, the chamber of the new Palace of Westminster. What do we mean by the new Palace of Westminster? It seems to many people, because of the architecture, because of the image it gives, that it's quite an old building. What happened?
Well, in 1834, the old Palace of Westminster that had been on site and grew over time, over 800 years, burned down. And here's another myth that's worth busting. Many accounts, secondary accounts of the fire that you see in books about the new Houses of Parliament, the building that replaced the old one, say that people stood around clapping and cheering when the Houses of Parliament burned down because they were so happy. They thought the politicians were were inside the building. Well, first of all, they weren't inside the building at the time.
They also thought some of the legislation they didn't like would burn
down.
That's
right. They thought
would burn because, and then would be invalid.
That's right. They thought because, you know, if the legislation were in there, you know, it would cease to become legislation anymore. And in particular, they were thinking of the Poor Law Amendment Act, which had just been passed by Parliament a few months before the fire. That's the famous act that created what we think of as the Victorian workhouse system, which Dickens obviously famously portrayed in Oliver Twist. But in actual fact, if you look at eyewitness accounts of the fire, people's diaries and newspaper accounts and letters and so on, what's actually going on is that there are some cheers, there are a bit of clapping, but it's not because people are delighted the Houses of Parliament are going up in flames. It's actually, I think, because this was the most overwhelming spectacle for the huge crowds that gathered to see the fire. It was quite outside their normal experience of light. Mm-hmm. People would have been used to fireworks at coronations and in the pleasure gardens across the river at Vauxhall. But it was an age before limelight. It was an age before, obviously, before electric lighting and flood lighting and so on. And really, this display of light from the fire, which lit up the London skyline and could be seen from 30 miles away, it was the most significant fire between 1666, when the City of London burned down, and the Blitz in 1940-41. It was actually terrifying for people. And the whole spectacle became, if you like a theatrical performance. It was so overwhelming, and people's only response to the amazing flames that were shooting up into the sky and the intense emotional experience, the fear that they were feeling and the bravery of the firemen who were trying to save the building was actually to clap as if they were in a cinema or a theatre or something like that. Today we'd say it was a cinematic experience, and it's almost, you know, they're sort of standing back for it. It's almost like they've got that sort of, you know, that theatrical glass wall between the audience and the actual spectacle.
It's as if it's the greatest fireworks show they could ever imagine. And the fire was huge. It was multicolored too, because all sorts of things burned, and the flames are in different
colors. So, you know, this was just
kind of gorgeous in a way.
Yes, a spectacular form of entertainment, really, in some cases, but entertainment of a very sort of sinister kind.
And painted very famously by the Impressionist Turner.
That's right.
Paintings you can see, and we'll put up on the website.
Yeah, and they're in America today, actually.
Yeah, one is in Cleveland, and one's Philadelphia.
That's right. And in fact, the fire of 1834 and the old palace is very little known in the UK. And I think one of the reasons for that is that these very famous paintings by Turner are in the States.
Right.
If they'd been hanging on the walls of Tate Britain, where much of the rest of Turner's collection is, I think our collective memory in the UK would be much, much firmer about the fire.
Right, well, you can buy them back.
So, I mean, that leads on to your where we started with your question, which was most people might think that the Houses of Parliament today are a medieval building. Well, they're not. They're built in the medieval Gothic style.
Right.
Because following the fire, there was a competition, and one of the rules of the competition was that the building should be in the Gothic or Elizabethan style, as the terms of the competition put it. And so Charles Barry, with the help of Augustus Pugin, won that competition. We have the spectacular Victorian Gothic building before us.
Yeah, and there are lots of reasons for that, Buzzkillers. It's not just because the old building was Gothic. It's because Westminster Hall is right next door, because the politicians thought that it would look better, you know, in sympathy with the architecture of,
yes,
the area.
Yes, we didn't want any of those filthy continental Grecian models like in France or in the capital.
Yeah, the U.S. capital. That's right.
Exactly.
So because the trend towards legislative buildings was very much classical.
Absolutely. And with what we would call in Europe a hemicycle. So this, I don't know what you call it in the States, but the semicircular chamber.
Right.
Rather than what we have in the UK, which is this rectangular chamber with the two sets of benches running down the long side of the rectangle.
Okay, fantastic. So now we have the building. We know where we are. We know the building's been burned down, and we know that it's going to be rebuilt in an old style. We need to take an ad break right now and thank our Kickstarter supporters. So many of you helped us get this whole thing started. Your Kickstarter money not only provides for the equipment and the podcast and hosting and the licensing and the distribution, but it paid for my big fat first class plane ticket over here and my swanky hotel in Kensington in London and the booze and the food that I've been scarfing down all week. So thanks for that. It's been great. Now, back to Caroline. We've got the building burnt down and then we've got it sort of rebuilt. We started talking about rebuilding. What else about the building is misunderstood? Has been mythologized?
Yeah, if we're talking about the rebuilding, as I mentioned, Charles Barry and Augustus Pugin together designed the palace. There was big controversy for many decades over who was responsible, and I think today what we can say is that it was a collaborative joint effort. Mm-hmm. It's indistinguishable in some parts, you know, who actually designed which bit. They worked very closely together. But one of the main myths perhaps to bust at this point in the story is that designing the palace drove Pugin mad.
Right.
Pugin died in 1852.
Right. Young,
he was 40 years old, and you know he was an artistic genius. He was the creator of, you know, the Victorian Gothic style in England and across the world. In fact,
the very heavy tracery, the very ornate nature of the building is largely due to him.
So the fantastic, colourful tiles on the floor, the wonderful patterns in the woodwork and the curtains and the carpet designs and so on. All of this was Pugin's inspiration, and similarly, you know, he was responsible for the designing of the top tier of the clock tower, which you now know has Big Ben inside it. that's this really iconic symbol of London. That was definitely Pugin, because Barry knew what he wanted overall, but couldn't get the detail right, which is where Pugin stepped in. Anyway, did it drive Pugin mad? And the answer is no. He was certainly under a lot of pressure in the lead up to his death, because the House of Commons chamber was due to be opened in 1852.
Right.
He'd done a huge amount of work with Barry to help with the opening of the House of Lords chamber, which was in 1847, and the great golden throne in the House of Lords, which is where the monarch sits during the state opening of Parliament, which is like your State of the Union speech in the US. But it didn't drive him mad. I mean, he was already working at full throttle throughout his life anyway. And it's now believed that he was in fact suffering from a combination of hyperthyroidism and syphilis.
Ah.
And he'd probably been suffering from syphilis since he was in his teens. He probably caught something a bit nasty from one of the ladies who used to hang around the Covent Garden theatre.
Yeah. And syphilis famously kills you young.
Well, yeah, it was. There wasn't really a treatment for
at
this
then.
Point. Yeah. He was having mercury treatment in his eyes, which is very suggestive of, you know, some sort of syphilis-related illness. But towards the end of his life, from about 1851. Oh, we can hear.
I was just checking to make sure that was coming through.
We can hear the bell. That was the hour bell going.
Yeah.
And we might hear the bongs. We're going to hear 11 bongs now, I think, coming through.
Ten, sorry.
Yeah. Haven't quite got used to British summertime.
There it is. There's the first one.
Okay.
Well, Buzzkillers, I hope you hear that clearly. That's three. I think one of the reasons people thought Pugin, I mean, the rumor, the nasty rumor that went around that he went mad, is because he was overwrought with his Catholicism and the way his art was expressing that Catholicism was driving him.
Yes, I mean, he was obviously thought to be a slightly suspect character. He was he was very flamboyant. He was very passionate. He was very, very vocal about his conversion to Catholicism, and you know, he was a if you like a polemicist for Catholic art.
Right.
But it's a physical, you know, it's a physical illness that drove him mad, not the pressure of working on the palace and actually working on the Great Exhibition the year before he died as well.
That's right.
You know, he drove himself to extremes. That's certainly true. And I also wonder whether there wasn't some sort of bipolar thing going on there as well. But you know, he was an exhausted man, certainly. But he, you know, there's a physical reason for his madness.
Yeah, and portraits of him, you see him. He's very skinny and very pale.
Yeah, he's really pasty.
He doesn't look well. Whereas Barry, Charles Barry, the main architect, looks healthy and hearty.
Yeah, although he did have a few sort of moments of illness himself. He turned vegetarian in the middle of the 1840s in order to improve his health due to stress-related problems with the palace. So.
All right. Well, those are sort of the big myths, the myths about the architecture, the myths about where the building is sited. What about there must be some fun sort of strange myths.
Yes, so there are a whole load of weird urban myths that we in the parliamentary archives have to constantly try and battle. So the Houses of Parliament, the old Houses of Parliament, were actually the location of the only assassination of a British Prime Minister. In 1812, the Prime Minister, Spencer Perceval, was shot dead by a madman called John Bellingham, who had a grudge against the government. And Spencer Perceval was shot dead in the lobby of the House of Commons, so the anteroom in front of the debating chamber. An urban myth, which still has a certain degree of hold on people who work in the building, was that the arrangement of the tiles in the place where Spencer Perceval collapsed after being shot showed the exact spot where he died.
Right.
And this is frankly nonsense, because the tiles are actually on the floor of the building that replaced the lobby after the fire. So, you know, there's no particular spot that's identifiable. And in fact, he didn't die on the floor of the lobby anyway. He was carried to a side room and he died in the speaker's chaplain's study, I think, in actual fact, on a table somewhere. And I think, in fact, all that had happened was that after the palace was bombed in the Second World War. That area was badly damaged and the tiles had to be relayed, and some workmen just got it wrong. They relayed two tiles the wrong way round. That's all it was. But, you know, this urban myth took hold that this was the spot where the Prime Minister died. So that's one that I'd like to tick off, please.
I have to say that the first time I took a tour, an official tour of the palace, the tour guide told us that. He told us that this is where he died, and these tiles are arranged in this way for that reason.
I'm afraid that's nonsense. And, you know, what sort of a tribute is it to someone to lay two tiles back to front to commemorate that?
Something greater than that.
It's not very dignified, is it? In actual fact, what there is now today, the tiles have been relayed quite recently.
Oh, really?
Because these are the encaustic tiles designed by Pugin. These are clay-coloured tiles reproducing medieval patterns. They were relayed in the last 12 months or so as part of a restoration process, and the tiles have been laid the right way round again.
So that's
gone forever. But there is now a more dignified plaque close by on the wall saying this was the sort of location where Spencer Perceval was gunned down.
Yeah. Right.
Another one is that you can't die inside the Houses of Parliament.
Which, obviously, Spencer Percival...
yes, obviously, Spencer Percival wasn't taking any notice of. I mean, this is another fantastic urban myth. I don't know how people can, you know, decide not to die inside the Houses of Parliament if that's going to happen to them. But this is just based on a bit of a garbled idea about legal jurisdiction. Because the Houses of Parliament are still technically a royal palace, the Palace of Westminster, it means that it doesn't come under the jurisdiction of the normal coroner's courts in London. It's actually technically within the jurisdiction of the royal coroner. And somehow that has become garbled, meaning that you can't die. I think what it actually means is that, you know, if somebody were sadly to collapse and die actually on the premises, their inquest would have to be held in a particular way. I mean, not in the Houses of Parliament, but, you know, there might need to be a bit of legal paperwork associated with it. But
and the death certificate might look,
It doesn't mean that, you know, if you die in the Houses of Parliament, somehow your death certificate is forged and another location is given.
Or you can't die because they don't want to go through that whole tile controversy again.
Exactly so. Another one we often get asked in the parliamentary archives is, why is it that only Cavalier King Charles Spaniels are allowed in the Houses of Parliament. Do you have Cavalier King Charles Spaniels?
We have King Charles Spaniels. What are Cavalier?
I think they're the same. I think they're the same.
All right, yeah.
This is another bizarre
They're the only
story.
Dogs allowed. No dogs are allowed except for...
This is the myth somehow these are the only dogs allowed in the palace. And this is total nonsense as well. I don't know where this has come from. I think it might have to do... I really don't know where this has come from. I think it's something to do with the fact that King Charles Spaniels are associated with Charles II.
Right.
And this was a royal palace, and therefore maybe, somehow these were the only dogs allowed on the premises. It's all nonsense. First of all, you know, guide dogs and other assistance dogs are most definitely welcome and seen around the palace. And, you know, we have tactile tours for the visually impaired, and their wonderful dogs come in and, you know, check out the interiors as well.
Those dogs can be any breed.
Those dogs can be any breed.
Any guide dog breed.
Absolutely. Any guide dog breed can come in. Otherwise, obviously, ordinary dogs can't come in. But any assistant dogs of any breed are welcome inside the Houses of Parliament. And there has never, as far as we know, been any sort of historic ban on other dogs.
Well, this is fascinating because you have not only such a big and important building, right, in the middle of London and, of course, in the middle of the British Empire at its height, but you have big, genuine myths that relate to the Constitution, that relate to British history, and also these small little silly myths. So it's a cluster. There's a sort of a galaxy of myths, and you can pick out any one of them and have fun with them. But right now we need to take another ad break and have a big shout out to our friends at the Epicast Network. We are in the Epicast Network, and by being here in London, we have stretched the boundaries of the Epicast Network further than it's ever been stretched before. But here's an ad, here's a promo from another show on Epicast.
Sorry to break you away from your favorite Epicast podcast, but we had to tell you about Does This Hold Up Podcast. It's a new show on the Epicast Network. We take movies, we analyze them, we find out if they still hold up.
Analyze? More like scrutinize.
Yeah.
No one's safe.
Nobody's safe.
So don't forget to listen to
Does This Hold Up Podcast.
Buzzkillers, we're back. I hope you like that Epicast ad, and I hope you listen to that Epicast show. We've had a great discussion with Dr. Caroline Shenton, and you know what that means. It means we're exhausted, we're tired, and we need to relax with a game. And that means Churchill quote or no quote. Yes, Buzzkillers, I dragged the Churchill quote or no quote wheel onto the airplane through customs on both ends, and it was very heavy and it was a huge pain in the neck. I had to get it through security here at the Houses of Parliament, and it is now in Westminster Hall, the only time a Professor Buzzkill Churchill quote or no quote wheel has ever been in the Houses of Parliament. So this is a historic moment. The Churchill supposed quote I'm going to offer up is this, quote, and it's very apropos, if it's true, very apropos to what we're talking about. Quote, we shape our buildings, and afterwards our buildings shape us. So, Caroline, we always have the guest spin the wheel. So if you'll reach over and give the wheel a spin, and then we'll talk about whether we think, oh, there it goes. Good spin. Delicate, but powerful still.
Well, you know, that's me all over.
Okay, so now I'm gonna say no quote. The reason I almost always say no quote is because there's so many famous misquotations of Churchill. But the wheel is spinning. We can't tell how it's going to answer yet. What answer are you going to give?
Well, I think I know the answer to this.
Oh, you know? Oh no! There's an expert on the show. Yeah.
I think it may be right.
It may be an actual quote.
It may be an actual quote.
Okay. Well, the wheel's slowing down. It's slowing down, and you're right. It is an actual quote. The quote. I'm going to read the quote out in full. And since you obviously know about the quote, perhaps you can give us more background. He said in the House of Commons in October 1943, quote, on the night of May 10th, 1941, with one of the last bombs of our last serious raid, that's the Battle of Britain, our House of Commons was destroyed by the violence of the enemy, and now we have to consider whether we should build it up again and how and when. We shape our buildings, and afterwards our buildings shape us. Having dwelt and served for more than 40 years in the late chamber, and having derived very great pleasure and advantage therefrom, I naturally should like to see it restored in all its essentials to its old form, convenience, and dignity. Now, there's a lot in that quote that deals with a lot of the things we've talked about. Perhaps you can elaborate.
Yeah, so the Houses of Parliament were hit 14 times during the Second World War.
Yikes.
During the Blitz. And the worst night was the 10th and 11th of May 1941, when the House of Commons chamber received a direct hit, it was destroyed, and Westminster Hall was covered with incendiary bombs, which are those bombs that set fire to things, and the roof was in great peril. And a bomb went through the roof of the House of Lords as well and didn't explode. It just landed in the floor of the House of Lords but left a big hole in the roof. And the decision was made on the night to let the Commons Chamber perish and save Westminster Hall, which is, of course, exactly the same decision that had been made in 1834 when the building was burning down. Mm-hmm. And the context of this quote from Churchill 2 years after the bombing was during the debate about should they rebuild the Commons Chamber as it was to the same design that Barry and Pugin had delivered in 1852, or should it be a different sort of design, this sort of hemicycle design, such as on the continent and in the US? Should it be at Westminster at all? In fact, should Parliament move away completely from Westminster? Because at the time they'd been relocated into different buildings close by during the war. So it was this huge debate really about the building, but really underlying it was a much bigger debate about, you know, the nature of democracy in the UK and the pull that Westminster had over people from a historic point of view. And ultimately, they decided to stay at Westminster. It was never really in question, but there certainly were MPs who were saying, well, let's move outside London, let's move somewhere where we can have a proper railway station and aerodrome, and we can be, you know, properly accommodated in modern accommodation.
So
that's
a lot
the context.
Complaining that there weren't enough offices for MPs and lords and things like that. Yeah,
it's actually a very narrow site here. It's a very cramped site, right? Because we're right on the river here, there's nowhere to expand on one whole side, and the actual site itself is cramped because on the other side you've got Westminster Abbey, and clearly you can't shift that either.
Yeah. Raise that to the ground.
Exactly. So
smoking room for.
So it's not like Washington DC where there's this plateau that you can expand across. Yeah. So there's always been an issue with accommodation at Westminster.
And that's been a continuing theme. I mean, in this half an hour or so, we've talked about an old palace, then a palace, old houses of parliament get destroyed, get rebuilt in a style that they like to think has echoes to the old one, and then it gets destroyed again, at least part of it gets destroyed again, and rebuilt again in the style that and form that it had had before. So that the idea of continuity and the idea of tradition is very strong here.
Yeah, and where we're sitting now in Westminster Hall is the exact symbol of that, because here's this great building that's over 900 years old, and it's survived all of these terrible disasters by the skin of its teeth, and it's still here.
Yeah, that's right. It does survive the 1834 fire and does survive World War II bombing. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Shenton. This has been most illuminating.
Thank you, Professor Buskin.
I'm so happy we were able to have the interview in the hall, right? Because I think that'll give our listeners an added benefit of feeling like they're actually here. Talk to you later, Buzzkillers.